Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Cheers to MOTAT, as always. So, first up, we are talking about coronavirus, is that right?
We are. So, 2 weeks ago, I didn't talk about coronavirus, and I felt a big sense of loss, so I thought I better...
Got to make up for it.
I've got to make up for it. So this is sort of like a recap, maybe, or like a catch up. Where are we now with coronavirus? So obviously it's been around for about 6 months now, a little more than 6 months. So it was December 2019 that it started emerging, and 6-7 months later, we've got more than 10 million confirmed cases worldwide. More than 500,000 people have died. This has obviously been a worldwide event, but there are we've learned an awful lot about the virus and how it enters cells and how it causes illness and death. But there's still a lot of questions that are outstanding. So I'll just sort of briefly cover a few of those today. One of the questions, and I think this is really interesting, is why do some people respond really differently to infection? So some people get extremely sick or they die, and some people have no response at all. They just feel fine. So this is a really striking aspect of COVID-19. The reasons for this are still sort of trying to get found out. So there's been several studies and some indications. There's been a big study of about 4,000 people in Italy, Italy and Spain, turned up some genetic links to severe COVID-19 responses. So people who developed respiratory failure were more than likely to carry one of two particular gene variants than were people without the disease. So people who had a severe response had they carried particular genes. People with less severe responses didn't tend to carry those genes. So
does that explain why some people kind of get some symptoms and not others, or does
it go? I think this is early days. I don't know. Waiting on science. It takes time. One variant of these genes lies in the region of the genome that determines AB or ABO blood type. So this is related to blood type. The other is near several genes, including one that encodes a protein that interacts with the receptor to the virus uses to enter human cells. So, and there's two others that encode molecules linked to immune response against pathogens. So things that you might expect could be related to how the virus interacts with the body, but they're responsible, possibly. Another question, what is the nature of immunity and how long does it last? People have been talking in some countries a lot about herd immunity. So if enough people get the disease and recover, then the population will be safe. And I think that is increasingly being shown to be a bit of a myth. There's a lot of work going on to try and see how long you are immune. So if you get COVID-19, are you immune to getting it again? Or could you get it in a year or 2 years or something like that? There's been a lot of effort focused on neutralizing antibodies, which things that bind to the protein, to viral proteins, and prevent infection. And they've shown that these levels of neutralizing antibodies against the virus remain high for a few weeks after infection, but then typically begin to wane. These antibodies might linger at high levels for longer in people who have had severe infection. So the more virus, the bigger the immune response. It doesn't look too promising about long-term immunity. Although researchers don't yet know what level of neutralizing antibodies is needed to fight off reinfection, it's still unclear, but it doesn't look great that you're going to get long-term immunity from catching COVID.
What does that mean for the vaccine? Like if you had a vaccine, obviously you'd hope, right, that that's lifetime immunity, but...
But we have to have a flu vaccine every year and things like that. So that's another question. So how well will the vaccine work? It's again, it's still unclear. There are currently about 200 vaccines in development around the world, and about 20 of those are in clinical trials. And the first large-scale efficacy trials to find out if these vaccines actually work or not are going to begin in the next few months. But there are clues. So we haven't really had large-scale tests in humans, but there are clues in data from animal studies. These are in macaque monkeys, for instance. Studies in macaque monkeys suggest that the vaccines might do a good job at preventing lung infection and resulting pneumonia, but not so good a job at blocking infection elsewhere in the body, such as the nose or something like that. Yeah. So these results raise the possibility that COVID-19 vaccine will prevent the severe version of the disease, but wouldn't actually stop the spread of the virus. Yeah. There is some data in humans. It's a bit scant, but the data suggests that the vaccine prompts our bodies to make neutralizing antibodies that can block the virus from infecting cells, but it's not yet clear whether levels of the antibodies are high enough to stop new infections or how long they persist. Mm-hmm. So, again, things to find out. There are some questions about whether the virus has developed any mutations, any worrying mutations. So there's various stories about, you know, particular countries having particularly severe death rates or a lot more severe infections. And viruses certainly mutate, and this one has no doubt mutated, but it's whether those mutations have caused any more severe illness. The mutations actually can be used to trace the spread of the virus. So as it mutates and goes to different places, you can track that. But most mutations have no impact. Picking out the worrying ones is difficult. Researchers are debating whether widespread prevalence of one particular mutation that's been found. This is in the virus's spike protein. There's sort of these spiky structures on the virus's surface. Is actually a mutation that has made the virus more virulent. This particular mutation seems to have emerged around February in Europe, possibly has been linked to more severe responses to the virus.
Yikes!
Oh, right. Yeah, that's very interesting.
If you've got time.
Well, I was just going to say that it's a lot of coronavirus news, but we'll run out of time for the rest, unless this one is very important.
I can easily move on. The last one is about the origin, and we've already talked about that already, so that's not.
So next up, you were going to talk about the concerns around DNA collection in China.
Yeah, so there's been a report revealing that China has been trying to collect DNA from millions of men to try and help solve crimes. But this is raising a lot of concern about privacy and consent in China. So people have very little control over how this information, their DNA information, is being used. And often they don't understand the implications that it has for them and their families. So China is aiming to collect and store genetic profiles of roughly 10% of the country's male population, as there's as many as 70 million people, according to this report. The report estimates that those DNA profiles can be used to construct genetic links to China's entire male population.
So is this to find genetic evidence on crime scenes? Or?
This is, the Chinese government say the database will help it track down criminals,
right,
who are mostly male. So there's a gender bias here, obviously. But the report also talks about its effect on the government operations to deepen social control.
Right.
Yeah. Certainly human rights activists say a genetic database containing information about people without a criminal history is really unprecedented. Mm. And the key thing about this particular, the type of DNA or the type of information that is being collected is that it can be used to track down family members who have not given DNA samples. So the database catalogs markers known as short tandem repeats. These are repeating regions of DNA that are specific to the male defining Y chromosome, and why specific STRs, these short tandem repeats, are extremely similar between men in the same male lineage. This means that if you have a sample from one person, it can be linked to all the male relatives on his paternal side.
Wow.
So you can really extend this this link to people who have not given any permission this information to be collected. So, so this is causing a little bit of
fair enough.
Obviously, yes.
Yeah, so I think we have some time to quickly touch on this last one, which I think is quite interesting, and that's that scientists are kind of moving away and stripping offensive names from journals and awards and stuff like that.
Yes, and I think this is probably certainly a recent thing, but it's been going on for quite a long time. There are a lot of examples that are now coming to light of either racist scientists that have been commemorated in one way or another, racist terminology in science. So, for example, the article that I read about this talks about a herpetologist who studies the habitat and behavior of particular lizards, and they talk about noosing as a way of catching the lizard.
Right.
And this is clearly, and this is in the southwestern United States, and this is clearly a problematic term. And so, this particular scientist is trying to get the term changed to lassoing, which doesn't have the same sort of connotations. Mm. But this is a widespread thing. So there's scientific societies that are renaming major journals.
I feel like lassoing is probably not much better if we go down into the cowboy type stereotype. Anyway, again, this is
steps.
Probably better than noosing.
Of course. But again, the connotations. Anyway, yes, as you were.
So the major journals are being renamed. So there's one that honors a renowned 19th century researcher who held racist views. It's being changed. There's another society is voting on changing the name of a trivia competition that canonizes a prominent eugenicist. A famous example, do you know who Crick and Watson are?
No, Felix.
Nope.
Crick and Watson. James Watson and Francis Crick got the Nobel Prize in the 20th century for discovering the structure of DNA. These are two extremely eminent scientists, except one of them, in particular, James Watson, held extreme racist views and has promoted eugenics since his Nobel Prize.
Right.
And so there's a lot of efforts to sort of remove him from being commemorated. So, for example, Cold Spring Harbor Lab in the US is changing the name of his graduate school because of his previous comments. There are other examples. So in 2018, so this is a couple of years ago now, University of Michigan is removing the name of Clarence Cook Little, who was an influential 20th century geneticist who also supported eugenics. There's a lot of eugenicists here, so this tends to be a trend. The University of South Carolina, which itself has problematic history, is trying to remove the name of a physician, J. Marion Sims, from a woman's dormitory. He's known for inventing a particular type of vaginal speculum and techniques for gynecological surgeries, but the tools that he used and the surgeries that were developed through experimental surgeries on enslaved women conducted without anesthesia, and so...
Fuck's sake.
Yes.
Okay.
So...
Good job, get rid of that name.
Exactly, so they're doing that. But even so, the university's move has been controversial in the state. South Carolina is a very conservative state, having lived very near it for quite a long time. I know this, and people have said that changing the name of a stack of bricks and mortar is at the bottom of my to-do list, and that is one of the senators in South Carolina.
Right. It goes into we've had this conversation here recently around the statues, right? It goes into that where there's a concern when you start to change things or remove names where you're like removing the history, but actually it just actually ignites a conversation around the knowledge that we hold in regard or not.
Yes, it does. Mm. And are these is this history that we're removing, mm. or is this just a commemoration of history? Mm. Because history surely should be in libraries and museums and things
exactly.
like that.
And we can still access it.
And we can still access it if you really want to. And there are lots of other examples that I can go into, but this is
great.
Some of the things that are happening.
Very cool.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Marcus.
No problem.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology. Auckland.